Demoiselle said, I do not expect the technique to have been perfected, but you may have some sketch, some skeleton, some principle that you can use as guidance. Imperfectly, perhaps, but better than mere guesswork. No more than I had 8 years ago, said Selden mournfully. Here's what it amounts to, then. You must remain in power, and Joranum must be destroyed in such a way that imperial stability is maintained as long as possible, so that I may have a reasonable chance to work out psychohistory. This cannot be done, however, unless I work out psychohistory first. Is that it? It would seem so, Harry. Then we argue in a useless circle, and the Empire is destroyed. Unless something unforeseen happens. Unless you make something unforeseen happen.
I? Daniil, how can I do it without psychohistory?
I don't know, Harry. And Selden rose to go, in despair. Chapter 12. For days thereafter, Harry Selden neglected his departmental duties to use his computer in its news-gathering mode. There were not many computers capable of handling the daily news from 25 million worlds. There were a number of them at Imperial headquarters, where they were absolutely necessary. Some of the larger outer world capitals had them as well, though most were satisfied with hyper-connection to the central news post on Trentor. A computer at an important mathematics department could, if it were sufficiently advanced, be modified as an independent news source, and Selden had been careful to do that with his computer. It was, after all, necessary for his work on psychohistory, though the computer's capabilities were carefully ascribed to other, exceedingly plausible reasons. Ideally, the computer would report anything that was out of the ordinary on any world of the Empire. A coded and unobtrusive warning light would make itself evident, and Selden could track it down easily. Such a light rarely showed, for the definition of out of the ordinary was tight and intense, and dealt with large-scale and rare upheavals. What one did in its absence was to ring in various worlds at random. Not all 25 million, of course, but some dozens. It was a depressing and even debilitating task, for there were no worlds that didn't have their daily, relatively minor catastrophes. A volcanic eruption here, a flood there, an economic collapse of one sort or another yonder, and, of course, riots. There had not been a day in the last 1,000 years that there had not been riots over something or other on each of 100 or more different worlds. Naturally, such things had to be discounted. One could scarcely worry about riots any more than one could about volcanic eruptions, when both were constants on inhabited worlds. Rather, if a day should come in which not one riot was reported anywhere, that might be a sign of something so unusual as to warrant the gravest concern. Concern was what Selden could not make himself feel. The outer worlds, with all their disorders and misfortunes, were like a great ocean on a peaceful day, with a gentle swell and minor heavings, but no more. He found no evidence of any overall situation that clearly showed a decline in the last 8 years, or even in the last 80. Yet Demerzel, in Demerzel's absence, Selden could no longer think of him as Daniil, said the decline was continuing, and he had his finger on the Empire's pulse from day to day in ways that Selden could not duplicate, until such time as he would have the guiding power of psychohistory at his disposal. It could be that the decline was so small that it was unnoticeable till some crucial point was reached, like a domicile that slowly wears out and deteriorates, showing no signs of that deterioration, until one night when the roof collapses.
When would the roof collapse? That was the problem, and Selden had no answer. And on occasion, Selden would check on Trantor itself. There, the news was always considerably more substantial. For one thing, Trantor was the most highly populated of all the worlds, with its 40 billion people. For another, its 800 sectors formed a mini-empire all its own. For a third, there were the tedious rounds of governmental functions and the doings of the imperial family to follow. What struck Selden's eyes, however, was in the Dahl sector. The elections for the Dahl sector council had placed 5 Joranumites into office. This was the first time, according to the commentary, that Joranumites had achieved sector office. It was not surprising. Dahl was a Joranumite stronghold, if any sector was. But Selden found it a disturbing indication of the progress being made by the demagogue. He ordered a microchip of the item and took it home with him that evening. Raich looked up from his computer as Selden entered and apparently felt the need to explain himself. "I'm helping Mom on some reference material she needs," he said. "What about your own work?" "Done, Dad. All done." "Good. Look at this." He showed Raich the chip in his hand before slipping it into the microprojector. Raich glanced at the news item hanging in the air before his eyes and said, "Yes, I know." "You do?" "Sure. I usually keep track of Dahl. You know, home sector and all." "And what do you think about it?" "I'm not surprised. Are you? The rest of Trantor treats Dahl like dirt. Why shouldn't they go for Joranum's views?" "Do you go for them also?" "Well," Raich twisted his face thoughtfully. "I got to admit, some things he says appeal to me. He says he wants equality for all people. What's wrong with that?" "Nothing at all, if he means it. If he's sincere. If he isn't just using it as a ploy to get votes." "True enough, Dad. But most Dahlites probably figure, what's there to lose? We don't have equality now, though the laws say we do." "It's a hard thing to legislate." "That's not something to cool you off when you're sweating to death." Selden was thinking rapidly. He had been thinking since he had come across this item. He said, "Raich, you haven't been in Dahl since your mother and I took you out of the sector, have you?" "Sure I was, when I went with you to Dahl 5 years ago on your visit there." "Yes, yes," Selden waved a hand in dismissal. "But that doesn't count. We stayed at an intersector hotel, which was not Dahlite in the least. And as I recall, Doras never once let you out on the streets alone. After all, you were only 15. How would you like to visit Dahl now, alone, in charge of yourself, now that you're fully 20? Raich chuckled. "Mom would never allow that." "I don't say that I enjoy the prospect of facing her with it, but I don't intend to ask her permission. The question is, would you be willing to do this for me?" "Out of curiosity? Sure. I'd like to see what's happened to the old place." "Can you spare the time from your studies?" "Sure. I'll never miss a week or so. Besides, you can tape the lectures, and I'll catch up when I get back. I can get permission. After all, my old man's on the faculty. Unless you've been fired, Dad." "Not yet. But I'm not thinking of this as a fun vacation." "I'd be surprised if you did. I don't think you know what a fun vacation is, Dad. I'm surprised you know the phrase." "Don't be impertinent. When you go there, I want you to meet with Laskin Joranum." Raich looked startled. "How do I do that? I don't know where he's going to be.
He's going to be in Dal. He's been asked to speak to the Dal Sector Council with its new Joranumite members. We'll find out the exact day, and you can go a few days earlier.
And how do I get to see him, Dad? I don't figure he keeps open house.
I don't either, but I'll leave that up to you. You would have known how to do it when you were 12. I hope your keen edge hasn't blunted too badly in the intervening years.
Rach smiled.
I hope not. But suppose I do see him. What then?
Well, find out what you can, what he's really planning, what he's really thinking.
Do you really think he's going to tell me?
I wouldn't be surprised if he does. You have the trick of inspiring confidence, you miserable youngster. Let's talk about it. And so they did, several times. Selden's thoughts were painful. He was not sure where all this was leading to, but he dared not consult Hugo Amaryl or Demerzel, or, most of all, Doors. They might stop him. They might prove to him that his idea was a poor one, and he didn't want that proof. What he planned seemed the only gateway to salvation, and he didn't want it blocked. But did the gateway exist at all? Rach was the only one, it seemed to Selden, who could possibly manage to worm himself into Joranum's confidence. But was Rach the proper tool for the purpose? He was a Dalite, and sympathetic to Joranum. How far could Selden trust him? Horrible. Rach was his son, and Selden had never had occasion to mistrust Rach before. Chapter 13. If Selden doubted the efficacy of his notion, if he feared that it might explode matters prematurely or move them desperately in the wrong direction, if he was filled with an agonizing doubt as to whether Rach could be entirely trusted to fulfill his part suitably, he nevertheless had no doubt whatever, as to what Dora's reaction would be when presented with the fait accompli. And he was not disappointed, if that was quite the word to express his emotion. Yet, in a manner, he was disappointed, for Doris did not raise her voice in horror, as he had somehow thought she would, as he had prepared himself to withstand. But how was he to know? She was not as other women were, and he had never seen her truly angry. Perhaps it was not in her to be truly angry, or what he would consider to be truly angry. She was merely cold-eyed, and spoke with low-voiced, bitter disapproval. "You sent him to Dal alone?" Very softly, questioningly. For a moment, Selden quailed at the quiet voice. Then he said firmly, "I had to. It was necessary."
"Let me understand. You sent him to that den of thieves, that haunt of assassins, that conglomeration of all that is criminal?"
"Doors, you anger me when you speak like that. I would expect only a bigot to use those stereotypes."
"You deny that Dal is as I have described?"
"Of course. There are criminals and slums in Dal. I know that very well. We both know that. But not all of Dal is like that. And there are criminals and slums in every sector, even in the Imperial sector and in Streeling."
"There are degrees, are there not? One is not 10. If all the worlds are crime-ridden, if all the sectors are crime-ridden, Dal is among the worst, is it not? You have the computer. Check the statistics."
"I don't have to. Dal is the poorest sector on Trantor, and there is a positive correlation between poverty, misery, and crime. I grant you that.
You grant me that? And you sent him alone? You might have gone with him, or asked me to go with him, or sent half a dozen of his schoolmates with him. They would have welcomed a respite from their work, I'm sure.
What I need him for requires that he be alone.
And what do you need him for?
But Selden was stubbornly silent about that. Doris said,
Has it come to this? You don't trust me?
It's a gamble. I alone dare take the risk. I can't involve you or anyone else.
But it's not you taking the risk. It's poor Rach.
He's not taking any risk, said Selden impatiently. He's 20 years old, young and vigorous and as sturdy as a tree. And I don't mean the saplings we have here under glass on Trentor. I'm talking about a good solid tree in the Heliconian forests. And he's a twister, which the Dalites aren't.
You and your twisting, said Doris,
her coldness not thawing one whit.
You think that's the answer to everything. The Dalites carry knives, every one of them. Blasters, too, I'm sure.
I don't know about blasters. The laws are pretty strict when it comes to blasters. As for knives, I'm positive Rach carries one. He even carries a knife on campus here, where it's strictly against the law. Do you think he won't have one in Dahl? Doris remained silent. Selden was also silent for a few minutes, then decided it might be time to placate her. He said,
Look, I'll tell you this much. I'm hoping he'll see Joronum, who will be visiting Dahl. Oh? And what do you expect Rach to do? Fill him with bitter regrets over his wicked politics and send him back to Mycogen?
Come, really, if you're going to take this sardonic attitude, there's no use discussing it. He looked away from her, out the window at the blue-gray sky under the dome.
What I expect him to do,
and his voice faltered for a moment, is save the Empire.
To be sure, that would be much easier.
Selden's voice firmed. It's what I expect. You have no solution. Demerzel himself has no solution. He as much as said that the solution rests with me. That's what I'm striving for, and that's what I need Rach for in Dahl. After all, you know that ability of his to inspire affection. It worked with us, and I'm convinced it will work with Joronum. If I am right, all may be well. Doris' eyes widened a trifle.
Are you now going to tell me that you are being guided by psychohistory?
No, I am not going to lie to you. I have not reached the point where I can be guided in any way by psychohistory. But Hugo is constantly talking about intuition, and I have mine.
Intuition? What's that? Define it.
Easily. Intuition is the art, peculiar to the human mind, of working out the correct answer from data that is in itself incomplete, or even perhaps misleading.
And you've done it.
And Selden said with firm conviction, Yes, I have. But to himself he thought what he dared not share with Doris. What if Rach's charm were gone? Or, worse, what if the consciousness of being a Dalite became too strong for him? Chapter 14
Billy Button was Billy Button. Dirty, sprawling, dark, sinuous Billy Button. Exuding decay, and yet full of a vitality that Rach was convinced was to be found nowhere else on Trentor. Perhaps it was to be found nowhere else in the Empire, though Rach knew nothing firsthand of any world but Trentor. He had last seen Billy Button when he was not much more than 12, but even the people seemed to be the same. Still a mixture of the hangdog and the irreverent, filled with a synthetic pride and a grumbling resentment. The men marked by their dark, rich mustaches, and the women by their sack-like dresses that now looked tremendously slatternly to Rach's older and more worldly-wise eyes. How could women with dresses like that attract men? But it was a foolish question. Even when he was 12, he had had a pretty clear idea of how easily and quickly they could be removed. So he stood there, lost in thought and memory, passing along a street of store windows, and trying to convince himself that he remembered this particular place or that, and wondering if, among them all, there were people he did remember who were now 8 years older. Those, perhaps, who had been his boyhood friends. And he thought uneasily of the fact that, while he remembered some of the nicknames they had pinned on each other, he could not remember any real names. In fact, the gaps in his memory were enormous. It was not that 8 years was such a long time, but it was 2/5 of the lifetime of a 20-year-old, and his life since leaving Billy Button had been so different that all before it had faded like a misty dream. But the smells were there. He stopped outside a bakery, low and dingy, and smelled the coconut icing that reeked through the air, that he had never quite smelled elsewhere. Even when he had stopped to buy tarts with coconut icing, even when they were advertised as doll style, they had been faint imitations, no more. He felt strongly tempted. Well, why not? He had the credits, and Doris was not there to wrinkle her nose and wonder aloud how clean, or more likely not clean, the place might be. Who worried about clean in the old days? The shop was dim, and it took a while for Rach's eyes to acclimate. There were a few low tables in the place, with a couple of rather insubstantial chairs at each, undoubtedly where people might have a light repast, the equivalent of mocha and tarts. A young man sat at one of the tables, an empty cup before him, wearing a once white T-shirt that probably would have looked even dirtier in a better light. The baker, or in any case a server, stepped out from a room in the rear and said in a rather surly fashion, "What do you have?"
"A Coke icer," said Rach in just as surly a fashion.
He would not be a Billy Buttoner if he displayed courtesy, using the slang term he remembered well from the old days. The term was still current, for the server handed him the correct item, using his bare fingers. The boy Rach would have taken that for granted, but now the man Rach felt taken slightly aback. "You want a bag?"
"No," said Rach. "I'll eat it here."
He paid the server and took the Coke icer from the other's hand and bit into its richness, his eyes half-closing as he did so. It had been a rare treat in his boyhood. Sometimes when he had scrounged the necessary credit to buy one with, sometimes when he had received a bite from a temporarily wealthy friend, most often when he had lifted one when nobody was watching. Now he could buy as many as he wished.
"Hey," said a voice.
Rach opened his eyes. It was the man at the table scowling at him. Rach said gently, "Are you speaking to me, bub?"
"Yeah. What you doing?
Eating a Coke icer. What's it to you?
Automatically, he had assumed the belly button way of talking. It was no strain at all.
What you doing in belly button?
Born here?
Raised here. In a bed, not in a street like you.
The insult came easily, as though he had never left home.
That's so? You dress pretty good for a belly buttoner. Pretty fancy-dancy. Got a perfume stink about you.
And he held up a little finger to imply effeminacy.
I won't talk about your stink. I went up in the world.
Up in the world? La-dee-da.
Two other men stepped into the bakery. Rach frowned slightly, for he wasn't sure whether they had been summoned or not. The man at the table said to the newcomers,
This guy's gone up in the world. Says he's a belly buttoner.
One of the two newcomers shambled a mock salute and grinned with no appearance of amiability. His teeth were discolored.
Ain't that nice? It's always good to see a belly buttoner go up in the world. Gives them a chance to help their poor, unfortunate sector people, like credits. You can always spare a credit or two for the poor, eh?
How many you got, mister? Said the other, the grin disappearing.
Hey, said the man behind the counter. All you guys get out of my store. I don't want no trouble in here.
There'll be no trouble, said Rach. I'm leaving.
He made to go, but the seated man put a leg in his way.
Don't go, pal. We'd miss your company.
The man behind the counter, clearly fearing the worst, disappeared into the rear. Rach smiled. He said,
One time when I was in belly button, guys, I was with my old man and old lady, and there were 10 guys who stopped us. 10. I counted them. We had to take care of them.
Yeah? Said the one who had been speaking. Your old man took care of 10?
My old man? Nah. He wouldn't waste his time. My old lady did. And I can do it better than she can. And there are only 3 of you, so if you don't mind, out of the way.
Sure, just leave all your credits, some of your clothes, too.
The man at the table rose to his feet. There was a knife in his hand.
There you are, said Rach. Now you're going to waste my time.
He had finished his Coke icer, and he half turned. Then, as quickly as thought, he anchored himself to the table, while his right leg shot out, and the point of his toe landed unerringly in the groin of the man with the knife. Down he went with a loud cry. Up went the table, driving the second man toward the wall and keeping him there, while Rach's right arm flashed out, with the edge of the palm striking hard against the larynx of the third, who coughed and went down. It had taken 2 seconds, and Rach now stood there with a knife in each hand and said, Now, which one of you wants to move? They glared at him, but remained frozen in place, and Rach said, In that case, I will now leave. But the server, who had retreated to the back room, must have summoned help. For 3 more men had now entered the store, while the server screeched, Troublemakers! Nothing but troublemakers! The newcomers were dressed alike in what was obviously a uniform, but one that Rach had never seen. Trousers were tucked into boots, loose green t-shirts were belted, and odd semi-spherical hats that looked vaguely comic were perched on top of their heads. On the front of the left shoulder of each t-shirt were the letters J.G. They had the Dalite look about them, but not quite the Dalite mustache. The mustaches were black and thick, but they were carefully trimmed at lip level
and were kept from luxuriating too widely. Rach allowed himself an internal sneer. They lacked the vigor of his own wild mustache, but he had to admit they looked neat and clean. The leader of these three men said, "I'm Corporal Quinmer. What's been going on here?" The defeated Billy Bottoners were scrambling to their feet, clearly the worse for wear. One was still doubled over, one was rubbing his throat, and the third acted as though one of his shoulders had been wrenched. The corporal stared at them with a philosophic eye, while his two men blocked the door. He turned to Rach, the one man who seemed untouched. "Are you a Billy Bottoner boy?" "Born and bred, but I've lived elsewhere for 8 years." He let the Billy Button accent recede, but it was still there, at least to the extent that it existed in the corporal's speech as well. There were other parts of Dahl aside from Billy Button, and some parts with considerable aspirations to gentility. Rach said, "Are you security officers? I don't seem to recall the uniform." "We're not security officers. You won't find security officers in Billy Button much. We're the Joronoom Guard, and we keep the peace here. We know these three, and they've been warned. We'll take care of them. You're our problem, Buster. Name, reference number." Rach told them. "And what happened here?" Rach told them. "And your business here?" Rach said, "Look here, do you have the right to question me? If you're not security officers..." "Listen," said the corporal in a hard voice, "don't you question rights. We're all there is in Billy Button, and we have the right because we take the right. You say you beat up these three men, and I believe you. But you won't beat us up. We're not allowed to carry blasters." And with that, the corporal slowly pulled out a blaster. "Now, tell me your business here." Rach sighed. If he had gone directly to a sector hall as he should have done, if he had not stopped to drown himself in nostalgia for Billy Button and Coke Icers. He said, "I have come on important business to see Mr. Joronoom, and since you seem to be part of his organ..." "To see the leader?" "Yes, Corporal." "With two knives on you?" "For self-defense. I wasn't going to have them on me when I saw Mr. Joronoom."
"So you say. We're taking you into custody, mister. We'll get to the bottom of this. It may take time, but we will."
"But you don't have the right. You're not the legally const..."
"Well, find someone to complain to. Till then, you're ours."
And the knives were confiscated, and Rach was taken into custody. Chapter 15. Cleon was no longer quite the handsome young monarch that his holographs portrayed. Perhaps he still was, in the holographs, but his mirror told a different story. His most recent birthday had been celebrated with the usual pomp and ritual, but it was his 40th just the same. The Emperor could find nothing wrong with being 40. His health was perfect. He had gained a little weight, but not much. His face would perhaps look older if it were not for the micro-adjustments that were made periodically and that gave him a slightly enameled look. He had been on the throne for 18 years, already one of the longer reigns of the century, and he felt there was nothing that might necessarily keep him from reigning another 40 years, and perhaps having the longest reign in imperial history as a result. Cleon looked at the mirror again, and thought he looked a bit better if he did not actualize the third dimension. Now, take Demerzel. faithful, reliable, necessary, unbearable Demerzel. No change in him. He maintained his appearance, and as far as Cleon knew, there had been no micro-adjustments either. Of course, Demerzel was so close-mouthed about everything. And he had never been young. There had been no young look about him when he first served Cleon's father, and Cleon had been the boyish Prince Imperial. And there was no young look about him now. Was it better to have looked old at the start and to avoid change afterward? Change. It reminded him that he had called Demerzel in for a purpose, and not just so that he might stand there while the Emperor ruminated. Demerzel would take too much imperial rumination as a sign of old age. "Demerzel," he said. "Sire?" "This fellow Joranum, I tire of hearing of him." "There is no reason you should hear of him, sire. He is one of those phenomena that are thrown to the surface of the news for a while, and then disappears." "But he doesn't disappear." "Sometimes it takes a while, sire." "What do you think of him, Demerzel?"
"He is dangerous, but has a certain popularity. It is the popularity that increases the danger."
"If you find him dangerous, and if I find him annoying, why must we wait? Can't he simply be imprisoned or executed or something?"
"The political situation on Trantor, sire, is delicate."
"It is always delicate. When have you told me that it is anything but delicate?"
"We live in delicate times, sire. It would be useless to move strongly against him if that would but exacerbate the danger."
"I don't like it. I may not be widely read. An emperor doesn't have the time to be widely read, but I know my imperial history at any rate. There have been a number of cases of these populists, as they are called, that have seized power in the last couple of centuries. In every case, they reduced the reigning emperor to a mere figurehead. I do not wish to be a figurehead, Demerzel."
"It is unthinkable that you would be, sire."
"It won't be unthinkable if you do nothing."
"I am attempting to take measures, sire, but cautious ones."
"There's one fellow at least who isn't cautious. A month or so ago, a university professor..." "A professor stopped a potential Joranumite riot single-handedly. He stepped right in and put a stop to it."
"So he did, sire. How did you come to hear of it?"
"Because he is a certain professor in whom I am interested. How is it that you didn't speak to me of this?"
Demerzel said, almost obsequiously, "Would it be right for me to trouble you with every insignificant detail that crosses my desk?"
"Insignificant? This man who took action was Harry Seldon."
"That was indeed his name."
"And the name was a familiar one. Did he not present a paper some years ago at the last decennial convention that interested us?"
"Yes, sire."
Cleon looked pleased. "As you see, I do have a memory. I need not depend on my staff for everything. I interviewed this Seldon fellow on the matter of his paper, did I not?"
"Your memory is indeed flawless, sire."
"What happened to his idea? It was a fortune-telling device. My flawless memory does not bring to mind what he called it."
"Psychohistory, sire. It was not precisely a fortune-telling device, but a theory as to ways of predicting general trends in future human history."
"And what happened to it?"
"Nothing, sire. As I explained at the time, the idea turned out to be wholly impractical,
It was a colorful idea, but a useless one.
Yet he is capable of taking action to stop a potential riot. Would he have dared do this if he didn't know in advance he would succeed? Isn't that evidence that this, what, psychohistory is working?
It is merely evidence that Harry Seldon is foolhardy, sire. Even if the psychohistoric theory were practical, it would not have been able to yield results involving a single person or a single action.
You're not the mathematician, Demerzel. He is. I think it is time I questioned him again. After all, it is not long before the decennial convention is upon us once more.
It would be a useless...
Demerzel, I desire it. See to it.
Yes, sire. Chapter 16. Rach was listening with an agonized impatience that he was trying not to show. He was sitting in an improvised cell, deep in the warrens of Billy Button, having been accompanied through alleys he no longer remembered. He, who in the old days could have threaded those same alleys unerringly and lost any pursuer. The man with him, clad in the green of the Joranumite guard, was either a missionary, a brainwasher, or a kind of theologian monkey. At any rate, he had announced his name to be Sander Nee, and he was delivering a long message in a thick Dalite accent that he had clearly learned by heart. If the people of Dal want to enjoy equality, they must show themselves worthy of it. Good rule, quiet behavior, seemly pleasures are all requirements. Aggressiveness and the bearing of knives are the accusations others make against us to justify their intolerance. We must be clean in word and... Rach broke in.
I agree with you, Guardsman Nee, every word, but I must see Mr. Joranum.
Slowly the guardsman shook his head. You can't, lest you got some appointment, some permission.
Look, I'm the son of an important professor at Streeling University, a mathematics professor.
Don't know no professor. I thought you said you was from Dahl.
Of course I am. Can't you tell the way I talk?
And you got an old man who's a professor at a big university. That don't sound likely.
Well, he's my foster father.
The guardsman absorbed that and shook his head. You know anyone in Dahl?
There's Mother Rita. She'll know me.
She had been very old when she had known him. She might be senile by now, or dead. Never heard of her.
Who else? He had never known anyone likely to penetrate the dim consciousness of this man facing him. His best friend had been another youngster named Smudgy, or at least that was the only name he knew him by. Even in his desperation, Rach could not see himself saying, Do you know someone my age named Smudgy? Finally, he said, There's Hugo Amaril.